Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 22nd, 2007. This is Doug Henwin, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And first up, we'll be, in several minutes, talk with Michael Yates, who is an economist who's been on this show several times, mostly in his persona as an economist. But in this appearance, he will be wearing two hats, that of an economist and also a traveler, reporting on his voyages through the United States. So he's been traveling across the country, living in various cities and national parks and such over the last 5 or 6 years. And he's got a book just out from Monthly Review Press called Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, An Economist Travel Log, Michael Yates. And we'll talk to him pretty soon about that. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier today with Chris Fox of this new group. Well, he's actually with Ceres, which is a group that's been around about 17 years, but he'll be talking about a new group that Ceres put together, Investors and Business for U.S. Climate Action, which is a very interesting project of big investors collectively representing $4 trillion, as well as some large corporations and some foundations. And they will be pushing for the U.S. government to do something serious about carbon emissions and the threat of global warming. So this is kind of odd coming from that quarter, but we'll hear more about that, and I'll have some comments about that at the bottom of the hour. Some observations of the economic scene. First, the big news of the week, economically speaking, is that the Federal Reserve did nothing at its policymaking meeting earlier this week, only that they changed what they said about doing nothing. A few words of explanation. For decades, the Fed's policymaking arm, the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, FOMC, would meet every 6 weeks to decide whether to change their interest rate policy in the light of their analysis of the economy. But they wouldn't announce their decisions to the public. Wall Street economists would try to deduce policy changes from their behavior, but it was always a very imprecise science. About 10 years ago, though, under intense political pressure, the FOMC started issuing brief statements after their meetings, detailing any policy change, like, say, a quarter-point increase or decrease in the interest rate under their direct control, the so-called federal funds rate, and also their rationale for it. But the statements themselves have been like verbal ink blots, always a little vague and self-contradictory. It's fun to watch pundits declare what the Fed really meant in their latest statement, interpretations that are often 180 degrees apart, but delivered always with absolute certainty. This is especially true for the statement released yesterday afternoon. The statement noted that, quote, adjustment in the housing sector is ongoing, close quote, which dropped the phrase in the previous statement about how that market appeared to be stabilizing. That, then, sounds like they're worried about economic weakness, suggesting that they might cut rates sometime soon. But the next sentence said the economy seems likely to expand at a moderate pace, which is just what they presumably want, so that suggests no change. The next sentence notes that recent inflation readings have been, quote, somewhat elevated, end quote, a tendency that is likely to moderate over time, but the high level of resource utilization, as they put it, meaning, among other things, a low unemployment rate, has the potential to sustain those pressures going forward. So that passage suggests doing nothing or even tightening policy. And the concluding paragraph says that the FOMC's predominant policy concern remains the risk that inflation will fail to moderate. That sounds like they're not about to cut rates, doesn't it? But that last sentence of the statement reads, future policy adjustments will depend on the evolution of the outlook for both inflation and economic growth, as implied by incoming information, end quote. In their previous statement, they mentioned the possibility of additional firming, meaning raising rates to slow the economy. They dropped that phrase for a more balanced view. But the market seized on just that change and rallied like crazy. As I keep saying, financial market players are mostly an emotion-driven bunch. In this case, they heard what they wanted to, which is that the Fed might be easing soon. But a full reading of the text says maybe not. We'll see what Fedsters personally say in the coming days in press interviews as well as public speeches that might correct any possible misinterpretations the markets may have made. So despite the policy of apparent openness over the last decade, there's still a lot of high-end entrail reading going on. And just a couple of words about something just out from the Pew Center, their public opinion research branch. Pew Center has many branches, Hispanic Studies Center, environmental organization, but also a public opinion center. And they report a changing political landscape, increased public support for the social safety net, signs of growing public concern about income inequality, a diminished appetite for assertive national security policies. All these have improved the political landscape for the Democrats. I'm not sure this is the ideal vehicle for these kinds of concerns, but this is what they say, as the 2008 presidential campaign gets underway. At the same time, many of the key trends that nurtured the Republican resurgence of the mid-1990s have moderated, according to Pew's longitudinal measures of the public's basic political, social, and economic values. The proportion of Americans who support traditional social values has edged downward since 1994, while the proportion of Americans expressing strong personal religious commitment has also declined modestly. So we're seeing less religious intensity, less social conservatism, and more support for egalitarian social programs. Let's see how our politics reflect that. Let's take a little musical break, and we will talk with Michael Yates in a little bit. And that a bit from the Mekons, The Flame That Killed John Wayne. A church, a liquor store, an auto repair shop. That seems like a good bit of the American landscape. And we're now joined by someone who's been experiencing a lot of that landscape over the last 5 years, Michael Yates, who retired from the Johnstown's branch of the University of Pittsburgh in, I believe, 2001, and has been on the road pretty much ever since. Welcome to WBAI, Michael.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
So, is the church a liquor store and auto repair shop? Is that what a lot of America looks like as you're traveling around these days?
Well, I think that there's a certain truth to that. I mean, we noted a number of things in our travels, but one of them was kind of a growing uniformity of the way places look. You know, you see this growing urban, suburban, ex-urban sprawl, and at the same time, even the natural world becomes more uniform as you get all these destruction of species. I read a great quote from this writer named Charles Bowden. He said, "For people who hate to learn the name of things, the world is getting better every day." And I thought that was a pretty clever way to put some of the things that we've observed in terms of the landscape.
Or as Mike Davis said somewhere, the streets and suburban developments are named after the species that were rendered extinct in creating the development.
Right.
I should say you do have a book out from Monthly Review Press, Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist Travelogue, just out from MR Press. And there are a couple of themes in this that recur throughout, one being increasing inequality and the other increasing ecological destruction. And you know, we all know these things in abstract terms. Folks like you and me know the statistics, but you've been experiencing this all in a very direct way, right?
Yeah, well, we've been, you know, on the road about 100,000 miles now over the last 6 years, and we lived in all kinds of different places, and we've been on the road for long periods of time. And I tried to, you know, write a book that would be, a travelogue in a traditional sense, and give people a little bit up close and personal view of you know, the interesting things about our country. It's got a lot of physical diversity and beauty, but to try to put these in an economic and ecological context. And I guess I saw sort of three things that I knew about as an economist and as an observer and somebody that knows the data pretty well. But what we observed was, as you say, like a palpable divide between rich and poor, and no shame on the part of the rich in displaying their wealth. And just so many examples of this from so many different places. And in Miami Beach, you know, you see these incredibly lavish parties on a public beach, you know, sponsored by the Miami Heat basketball team. They had elephants, giraffes, camels on the beach. Guards were keeping the public away from them. You have these lavish wedding parties with fireworks displays that would boggle the mind of people in a small town. At the same time, you see a woman, you know, and she's real embarrassed. She's got a bar of soap, and she's bathing in the ocean. And then every day you see homeless people on the beach. And the one of the most telling ones we read about in the paper when we lived in Miami was a woman in Miami City hit a kid in a poor neighborhood in her fancy Mercedes, and she threw a $50 bill out the window rather than stopping.
Oh, my God.
In Estes Park, Colorado, where we lived last, you see these enormous big houses. And at the same time, two neighbors on each side of us where we lived, they had no indoor plumbing. They had outhouses. My mind was boggled. We found there's a certain irony in the title of the book because we found so many people living in motels. People that are working people and can't afford apartments, and you know, motels don't require the first and the last month's rent, and what have you. So we found a lot of people living in motels. A lot of cleaning people. A lot of the people that clean the rooms in the motels actually living in the motels. Just see that kind of stuff all the time, like decaying downtowns at the same time that all kinds of big houses are going up on the outskirts and in the suburbs and in the exurbs. So we really noticed that. And the second thing we noticed was, like, you get a lot of working people doing pretty mundane and degraded kinds of jobs. One good example I had of that is my own son when we lived in Portland, Oregon. He's working in this restaurant kitchen. Actually, it serves five restaurants. And they start smelling something real bad in the restaurant. Long story short, it's a decaying body in the hotel upstairs. And it's dripping down into the kitchen, the fluids from the decaying body. And the head of the kitchen says, put some wood chips on the flames to get rid of the smell. Doesn't shut down the kitchen. The police come. Nothing stops. I mean, you see that kind of stuff all the time. Environmentally, oh my gosh, you just see so many things. Like in Moab, Utah, which is really in this absolutely glorious setting. It's right outside the gates of Arches National Park and real close to Canyonlands National Park. There's this. They had a uranium boom there in the 1950s, and the place where they processed the uranium was close to town, and there's all these uranium tailings that they have to keep constantly wet to keep the dust from going into the air and exposing people to this uranium poisoning. Meanwhile, on the Navajo Nation, you got the Navajos that actually took tailings from the closed-down mines, not knowing that they were poisonous, and making cement out of them. So they've been sleeping on floors in their houses made out of contaminated uranium. And whereas they used to never have cancer, now they got it all the time. So just like little, you know, things like that, you start to observe up close. You see, you talk to people, and then you know that it really is happening. It's not in your, you know, it's not just in the numbers. Sometimes you see things and you say, that can't be true. Then you see it, and you say, oh, my gosh, it is.
Well, you know, I'm surrounded by a lot of this in New York City. I certainly write and broadcast about a lot of social and economic statistics, and you see a lot of it in New York City. But it's amazing to read through your book and see how pervasive it is across the United States, the polarization that we read about. You know, when the Census Bureau comes out with the annual income and poverty numbers, you read about more polarization and a sticky poverty rate, 12-13%, you know, by the very stingy official definition that just won't budge despite massive economic growth. And you see it, you know, up close every day.
You know, like I say, again, when we lived in Estes Park, which, oh, geez, that's a really pretty place. You know, it's like called the Switzerland of the United States. It's sitting in this gorgeous valley. They're called parks in the Rockies. And the Rocky Mountains are all around you, and it's just gloriously beautiful. But then you start talking to people like we joined a gym, and you start talking to the trainer, and he's got three jobs. And the woman next to us cleans houses, and she's got two or three, and she works as a secretary in this other place. She's got two or three jobs. You talk to the clerks in the grocery stores, and they're working a couple of jobs. The clerks in the motels and hotels, they're working two or three jobs, and not making much money. And you know, their eyes start to look tired by the end of the tourist season in early September and October, and that's in a small, beautiful town, much less in Portland, Oregon, where really and truly, I was really shocked by the number of homeless kids there. And I never saw an older Asian woman panhandling in my life. I just never did see that. I didn't see that in Manhattan. Maybe it's happening now, but I saw that in Portland. And you have these young kids just every day. I mean, it gets to be a hassle, you know. You have to admit it to yourself, even though you don't want to. You get sick of being accosted on every corner by these homeless kids looking for money. It's just depressing. And at the same time, Portland is really a pretty place. You know, they've got a clean downtown. You're surrounded by woods. It's just real interesting, these juxtapositions, you know, these huge big houses right near where we lived in Estes Park by the famous, I mean, in Portland by the famous Rose Gardens there. Huge big houses, but every one of them has Mexicans, you know, cleaning their yards and stuff, and the Mexicans are kind of invisible. So that, you don't have to put it this way. If you travel across the country, you really don't have to look very far if you keep your eyes open to see what you know is true from the data.
Yeah, it's like the Gilded Age of the late 19th century without the populace and the radical unions.
No, that's exactly what I was thinking. I made a little note of it. It's like going backwards. And one thing that it's taught me is that whatever gains are made by, you know, ordinary people through their struggles are never permanent. They're always under attack, and they can always be taken away unless you're vigilant and, you know, willing to fight back a little bit. And that's one of the things. Yeah, it is like the Gilded Age. That's a really appropriate.
But except there were populist and radical unions in those days.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying.
We don't have them now.
That's what I'm saying. We're going backwards without any sense. Well, without enough fight back, or not nearly enough. My goodness, that's for absolute sure.
I'm speaking with Michael Yates, who is a retired professor of economics, who is the author of Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate in the Economist Travelogue, just out for Monthly Review Press. And speaking of that politics, you talk to lots and lots of workers across the country, people working 2-3 jobs just to get by, people without health insurance, people who are deferring medical care because they couldn't afford to get attention paid to them. Was there any sense of a need for a union or a need for political organization, a need for different state policy, or was it just all they shrug their shoulders and accept this as their fate?
I think there's a lot of the latter, accepting it as their fate. I mean, there seems to be like a sort of a sense of disconnect between what's happening to people. Now, you know, there are exceptions because there were these big immigrant rallies and so on and so forth, you know, that immigrants were fighting back. And I'm not saying that there's no fight back, because that wouldn't be true. But there seems to be like sort of a disconnect, like a retreat into private life for most people. They feel sort of helpless about things. I think a lot of people do have some grasp. You know, they know the rich are getting richer, and they know their circumstances aren't very good. And they'll talk about that with you if you go into a grocery store and in Miami Beach and lots of places, though, we saw this, you know, a well-to-do person is in a store and they're on their cell phone and the clerk is ringing up their bill. And it's really rude to do that. You know, you're just chattering away to somebody. You're paying no attention to this poor clerk. And the clerk is as patient as can be and rings you up. And if you say afterwards, like Karen always says, I hate it when people do that, the clerk will always say, yes, that's extremely rude. I hate that too. You know what I'm saying? It's not like they're not grasping that.
But to move from there
to do anything about it, that's another matter. And so what happens is that the well-to-do monopolize all the political power, and there's an increasing privatization of all the public resources, and people are, you know, somewhat aware, but not in a detailed way aware of all the things that are going on. And so I don't know. I don't, you know, a friend of mine told me he was all optimistic. You know, things are going to change, and I don't know.
It's kind of,
I'm a pessimist, but
yeah.
But when you go across the country and you see these things, and you know, you hear a lot of chatter sometimes from people, but not all that much in the way of action. I mean, Portland has a reputation of being a liberal city, but I didn't see, like, you know, labor efforts. They never get publicity in the paper. There weren't that many of them. I mentioned that anarchist he's a real well known activist, an environmental activist. He opens up a restaurant, and when the workers join the IWW and start to unionize, he condemns them. I thought, if an anarchist environmentalist can't be sympathetic to workers, who could?
Well, you know, unions are stodgy old bureaucratic forms. They're not hip anarchist things, I guess.
Well, I guess what you said in that article that you wrote, you know, about that activistism, is that what you call it?
Yeah,
a lot of that kind of thinking.
I was really struck by some harsh criticisms of Portland, which is usually seen as a kind of enlightened and hip and cool place. But you said it was an extremely racist city.
Well, that's what I found just in terms of what you'd see and what you'd observe. I mean, first of all, I think Oregon had anti-miscegenation laws up until the 60s. And black people came into Portland to work in the shipyards in World War II, and they stuck them on a floodplain, and then the floodplain flooded, and then they moved them into a number of sort of isolated and separated urban ghettos, and that land's been taken over to build highways and one thing and another. So now the black community is really kind of sparse, and you know, there would be these incidents in Portland where you'd have a black person stopped for some minor offense and something would happen, and people end up being dead. You know, the police would shoot them. And when you'd see the articles in the paper or listen to the talk show host, you know, they'd say, you're stopped by the police. That's what happens to you when you talk back. And
you had a broken taillight, you need to get shot, right?
Yeah, and there was one black person lived in this apartment building we lived in, and when we'd bring that up to people, they'd say, geez, I hadn't noticed.
Oh my God!
No, I'm not joking. We asked that black person on the roof. McCarran asked him. There was a little, you know, garden up in the roof, like, and you could sit up there and look out over the city. And she asked the black person, "Well, how did it feel living in Portland? There aren't very many black people who live there, for one thing, and there seems to be this discrimination against black people and a lot of hostility towards them. What did it feel like?" And this other woman blew her stack saying, how do we dare have the nerve to ask him that question? And she said, there was plenty of diversity. Come out at 4 a.m. with me in the clubs and I'll show you diversity. Well, what she meant by diversity was something altogether different than what I meant about it. You know, you have a lot of people that have maybe sort of odd lifestyles in Portland. It's the capital of the raw food movement in the United States, where, you know, people want to eat nothing but raw food, including raw meat. And, well, that's okay. I don't care what people eat. If they want to eat that, that's fine. But that's not the kind of, you know, you put all your attention into that, you're different, but you're not bringing about any real social change, I don't think.
Yeah, well, it's about, a lot of it's about lifestyle, not social
organization. No, that's what I kind of found in Portland. You know, it is real liberal in a lot of ways, and it's a clean place. And I guess what makes you want to cry sometimes about a lot of several places that we saw in the United States was what tremendous potential they had. Like, I think Portland has the potential to really be, if wages were higher and you had more, say, worker-owned businesses and so on, it's a nice setting, and they have taken care of the environment to a much greater extent than most cities, with a green belt around it and so on and so forth, and a lot of physical beauty. You know, there are old trees right in town, heritage trees they call them, and it's pretty neat. And you think of the potential there, and then you think, is that likely to happen? And you think, well, probably not. I mean, Estes Park, same thing. I mean, Estes Park, they own their own electric company. And their electric rates were the lowest we've ever paid in Estes Park. And the city runs a surplus of $13 million a year or something like that. And this is a small place. And you think, well, there should be, like, pretty decent public housing for all these working people that serve the visitors to the Rocky Mountain National Park. And that could be done. And it really could be done. They could make their electric rates even lower. They could provide a lot of free entertainment for townspeople. And they do provide some, but not enough. And you think, well, these places really have a lot of potential. But instead, what you see is a lot of second homers coming into Estes Park. They stay long enough to get a vote for town things. And so they're going to build, like, this big performing arts center there. Well, it doesn't need a performing arts center, not really. They got the Stanley Hotel there where Stephen King wrote The Shining. They have all kind of public performances there. And there's lots of venues for that kind of thing. So instead, you get this divide. The Forest Service is going to sell off public lands, and you know those public lands are going to be used for developments of big houses for people with money that come in because it's a beautiful place. It's like, the more beautiful the place, the more the rich say they got to have it. They got to have every inch of it. They got to have all the good views and all the land and all the houses. And so I guess what makes you cry is you see potential and you don't think it's ever going to be fulfilled.
Well, it's interesting the way the polarization feeds in itself, too. The rich people come in, and there are more and more of them. They're richer and richer. And then they need the low-wage service workers to take care of them.
Well, that's what we noticed, like, in Jackson is a good example. I have that little quote in the beginning of that chapter saying that's what they say the billionaires are chasing out the millionaires in Jackson, Wyoming. And so you're right. I mean, you have, you know, these like Harrison Ford and all these rich people that live there. And then they got to have nannies, and they got to have maids, and there has to be a lot of hotel and big resort help. And then these people don't have any place to live. So in Aspen, Colorado, they actually had the owner of a resort telling his workers to live in the woods.
Oh, my God, really?
And actually, the workers actually went, and some of them were living in the woods. They built like lean-tos and stuff. It's like the farm workers that David Bacon's always reporting on, actually living out in the hills, you know, and when they get across the border, there's no place for them to live, so they live in the hills. Well, in Aspen, he told them to go live in the woods, and some of them were. And yet, at the same time, you have these people that get this land, and they actually cut down trees on public property so they get a better view. Like out in California, in Malibu or someplace, or I don't know if it was Malibu, but somebody actually bulldozed down sand dunes so that they would have a better view of the ocean. So, you know, you're right. It's like you get this incredible wealth, and it requires this enormous low-wage service economy to meet their every need. I mean, just on a slightly different note, at that one Hotel Victor in Miami Beach, they got a vibe manager, V-I-B-E, a vibe manager.
Just keep the vibe spreading around right, good vibes. Huh?
To have the right aromatherapy in the lobby.
Oh my God.
To have the right colored glasses, and the guests get to pick their own color formats for their rooms, you know, for sheets and towels and stuff like that. I thought that when I was in New York City, I couldn't believe a restaurant had a water sommelier.
That's ridiculous.
That was in New York City when we were there, but a vibe manager, well, that's even worse.
Well, I guess this is the social division of labor. It keeps getting finer and finer, doesn't it?
No, it certainly does.
So where are you now?
We're living right now. We're for a couple of months in Tucson, Arizona.
And what'd you find there? Pretty consistent with everything you report in the book.
Well, one of the things we noticed about Tucson, one of the things we noticed in the Southwest are the big desert cities, and they have all this space, and a lot of it had been public land, or a lot of it had been Indian land. And gradually, what you find is that private ownership starts to take over more and more and more of it. And instead of them having the sense to build like a nice downtown and sort of make it vertical like Portland did, and confined and decent, you know, or with some, you know, neighborhoods where people had lived historically, in this case they would be, you know, Hispanics and Indians, there's so much land, they sprawl out and out and out and out and out, and there's no water, so that's always a big problem. And what you get here in Tucson, like you get in Albuquerque, is like endless sprawl across the desert.
So
it's not eye appealing, and
yeah, it's a multiple ecological crime. They don't have the water, so that's crime one. Two is the immense amount of energy waste involved in people living in the desert and driving all over the place.
Oh no!
And then it's a crime against aesthetics to create such hideousness.
The University of Arizona, which is really pretty. It's not the University of New Mexico is my favorite, but in Albuquerque. But I like to go to university since I was a teacher. But the University of Arizona is really pretty, a nice place. And we're 12 miles away from it, where we're living. It takes us sometimes 45, 50 minutes. We went down to see Alexander Coburn give a talk there, and it took us 50 minutes to get there. And that's because the main drag in Tucson is called Speedway Boulevard. It's 35 miles long, and about 25 miles of those are strip malls.
Oh, God.
It's just endless. It's just endless strip malls, one after another. And the downtown of Tucson is just a catastrophe. There's sort of like those, those crappy buildings that were put up all over the place on colleges and so on in the 70s, you know, sort of concrete and glass and real horrible looking. Well, that's downtown Tucson. And, you know, the traditional neighborhoods that were there, they've been bulldozed or they burned down in a fire and weren't replaced. And instead, you just get this sprawl. And out here, you get, you know, these really big estates and these big adobe houses like in Santa Fe with just beaucoup acres, and people have horses, and then the horses ruin the trails that are on public property. And because, you know, when you have this big divide like this, the people that have money, they have political influence, and they get the right to use what little public land is left for their own purposes.
So it's like
they ruin that, too.
It's like beauty, whether natural or humanly created, is a luxury good now.
No, it certainly is. And, you know, and those that have a lot of money, they try to get it for themselves. You just see that. This big resort we talked about in Sedona where we took a hike. Sedona is just this glorious place where they used to make all these Western movies, and there's all these vortex sites there that are supposed to have this electrical energy, and New Agers used to come here and, you know, they have their meetings and they go out and get the spirit and what have you. And you get these giant big resorts like at the beginning of a beautiful canyon, and they don't block access to it because the canyon's public property, but you got to walk by it. You got to hear the lawnmowers running, and you got to see green grass in the desert, and you got to see the tennis courts, and you got to see the advertisements for these luxury spas where for $500-$600 they'll fix your body up. And then there's all these Indian motifs, which drives you absolutely crazy because the Indians around there are so desperately poor. And then to get to the beautiful canyon, you got to walk by that, and they have a private entrance to the canyon, private entrance to the hiking trail on this resort. It's called the Enchantment Resort. And it's just like, you're thinking to yourself, why should that be there? That shouldn't be there. Well, even in the national parks themselves, this divide means that, you know, you could go a whole day in the national parks and never see a person of color. That's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're out of time. I've got to thank you for joining us, Michael Yates, and I've got to say you really do a fine job in this book of combining the economic and social analysis with the personal memoir, mixing up the statistics and the human stories. Very, very nicely done. Michael Yates, author of Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist Travelogue, just out for Monthly Review Press.
And you can order it on Amazon, too. So.
Okay, you can order it anywhere you like.
Right.
Let's take a little break, and we'll be back.
Hello, it's Rick Berlin, and you're listening to WBI, New York City, New York City.
This is WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And don't forget to check out that website. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Chris Fox. And that bit of Schubert's Impromptu D-899, number 3, performed by Alfred Brendel. And suddenly, and by that I mean over the last 6 to 12 months, not the last 5 minutes, the corporate class is all alarmed by global warming. It was the big topic at the Global Elite's annual Gabfest in Davos, Switzerland last January. And a couple of weeks ago, the CEOs of the big three U.S. auto companies and Toyota appeared before a congressional committee to endorse limits on carbon emissions. And they failed to rise to the bait when a Republican member of the panel characterized the human contribution to greenhouse gas emissions as trivial. Even ExxonMobil, long the most recalcitrant of the oil companies, has a statement of concern on its website. When the auto and oil industries feel like they've got to talk the climate change talk, something is really happening. A milestone in the evolution of elite opinion was last October's publication by the British government of a Stern review, a detailed overview of the economics of climate change named after a former World Bank chief economist Nicholas Stern. While Stern's recommendations may look pretty weak, the report's major contribution was to argue, in conventional economic terms, that there would be substantial economic costs to doing nothing about climate change. Previously, elites preferred to whine about the costs of doing something. Another milestone was the creation just days before Bush's State of the Union address of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. Among the partners are such noted friends of the Earth as DuPont, GE, Pacific Gas and Electric, Caterpillar, and BP. But joining those corporate names are also some of the most business-friendly environmental organizations like Environmental Defense and the Natural Resources Defense Council. While the manifesto of this organization would never be confused with an Earth First document, it is remarkable to see such blue-chip corporate names signing any kind of green program at all. And this past Monday came the birth announcement for yet another group, this Investors and Business for U.S. Climate Action, and a coalition of institutional investors, including union and public sector pension funds and also some big private sector names, as well as foundations and businesses. Several of them already members of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. The investor members collectively control $4 trillion, which is huge, even by the standards of the U.S. financial markets. For someone like me, who distrusts these sorts of elite groupings and gravitates instinctively towards rabble-rousers, it's not easy to say this, but given the magnitude of the climate crisis, it's rather cheering to watch these developments. It remains to be seen just what this elite activism will mean, just what will they advocate, and how strongly. How will they react when the climate denialists launch their inevitable counteroffensive? So for a closer look at what's up with all this, I call the organizer of the Investor Consortium, Ceres. Ceres is one of those do-good investor groups that normally excites my skepticism. But in this case, like I said, I'm suspending some of my critical faculties, at least for the moment. Here is Ceres Director of Investor Programs, Chris Fox, in an interview recorded earlier today.
First, tell us about Ceres. Who are you?
Ceres is a coalition of investors and environmental groups that works with companies to improve company practices on climate change and other sustainability issues.
All right, so tell me how this initiative, the Investors and Business for U.S. Climate Action, how did this come to be?
We work with a number of companies that were concerned about the lack of certainty on national policy and were actually very concerned that they could not plan investments for the future. An electric power company, for instance, wanted to build a power plant but wouldn't know the rules of the climate change regulations that would affect that plant. So we started hearing from companies that they wanted national policy, and then we realized that investors could help support that call, and so we brought together a dialogue 6 months ago where investors and companies started to talk about what they could support together. So we have a historic agreement that was just announced on Monday where institutional investors and a dozen companies called on the federal government to act on climate change.
And what's the relation of this to the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which was founded in January?
Right. The investor component here is what makes this unique. The U.S. CAP Partnership was an alliance of environmental groups and businesses, and that was a terrific announcement that helped build momentum for national policy. And so this is similar in that it's part of a drumbeat of calls for national policy from the private sector, but this is an investor and business partnership that is really focused on the business and economic rationale. And what we've seen is the conventional wisdom of previous years was action on climate change is bad for the economy. What we have here is leaders of the economy, really big investors, including the largest pension fund, CalPERS, saying it's good for the economy if we act and it's bad for the economy if we continue to have this uncertainty.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about that. I think a lot of people would say, well, business just says, the hell with the environment. We just want to maximize profits over the next couple of quarters. Why this interest in doing something, and something rather dramatic about the climate issue?
Well, I think the smart business leaders are realizing that addressing climate change is major economic opportunity for the 21st century. And, to really address the risk we face from climate change, we need a fundamental shift in how we use and produce energy. And all sorts of new technologies and energy efficiency and renewable energy. This whole clean tech field is just surging, and many people are, seeing it as the new .com, basically. But there's a lot of momentum behind the business and investor communities in terms of profiting from the new technologies. Obviously, so profit motive is certainly one thing that's driving this. But there is a fear of loss as well. It's very profound, and the fear of both the regulatory risks that they don't understand because of the lack of certainty and the physical risks, which have really, I think, taken off in terms of consciousness. People are really much more attuned to those now that we've seen Hurricane Katrina hit and realize the connection between warmer oceans and stronger tropical storms.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this. There has been an amazing shift in political consciousness, even over the last 6 to 12 months on this issue, it seems to me. What is the timeline of this evolution that you see?
I'd say it's related to the rejection of the Kyoto Protocol by President Bush that led to a sense of despair that for the first part of the Bush administration, there was not much hope that things could change. And then once you had the Kyoto Protocol go into effect in February of 2005, you saw huge companies like GE realize that there was going to be a market for new technologies to sell products, basically, to countries that were regulating this. And so the regulations started to be viewed as an opportunity for companies. And then at the same time, you had the emergence of Al Gore's slideshow and movie, and you also had Hurricane Katrina. So you had some regulatory developments, some media and entertainment kind of industry movement, as well as the real physical risk hitting home. And then the Democratic Congress, I think, pushed everything over the edge to the point where we have some major momentum here in Capitol Hill.
What about the Stern Review? That came out last October. What struck me about that was that it introduced into economic discourse the idea that doing nothing actually costs money. Previously, everyone had said doing something would cost money, but Stern's really made the point that doing nothing would cost money. Did that have any influence?
Yeah, I think it had a somewhat significant influence. I think the debate about that report continues to rage, so it's had a mixed review in economics circles, but I think it absolutely drove home the point of the cost of inaction exceed the cost of action, and on a kind of a popular level, I'm not sure how much it reached the American public, but in terms of elite thinking, it certainly had a big impact.
I've noticed that conspicuously absent in a lot of these U.S. business groups that are concerned about climate change, the insurance industry. You would think that they would be concerned about this since they have to pay out big claims if storms get more severe. Can you do you have any thoughts on why they're missing in action?
Well, we have been pleased that the largest insurance company based in Europe, Allianz, signed on to the call to action released on Monday. So their signatory was quoted as saying that it's essential to put a price tag on carbon and, you know, enable the market to drive emissions reductions. And so we have some leadership by European-based insurers and some movement by AIG, the largest insurer in the world and, you know, the biggest U.S.-based insurer. They adopted a new climate change policy and have you know, made some important steps, but they haven't yet been willing to support national policy, and we're certainly hopeful that they will shortly.
I notice you do have Merrill Lynch's name on there, but a lot of other big investment banks and fund managers are not there. Are you still meeting some skepticism?
Well, we're in just the kickoff phase of this recruitment campaign to enlist more investors in Wall Street firms and companies to sign on. And we've been pleased to see the you know, statements coming out of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan over the last few years. Both of those companies support mandatory federal policy and actually differ with President Bush. There's been other firms doing things by themselves, and many firms, as you may know, like to do things on their own for marketing benefits and don't necessarily join in coalitions like this. So we see just a growing mainstream Wall Street sense that climate policy is inevitable, so we might as well just get on with it and understand how it's going to affect, you know, our markets and just get the rules right so that it puts in place something that investors can profit from.
And I also noticed there was an investor anxiety angle that they were concerned about potential liabilities.
Absolutely. Yeah, the first way that there's liability is obviously the direct litigation risk. And there are companies that have been sued now by attorneys general. Elliott Spitzer and a whole coalition of attorneys general filed suit against five of the largest electric power companies, and that suit is on appeal right now. But there are other potential litigation risks. And then the regulatory risks, which are significant as governments worldwide move to regulate emissions. California has got a law, 10 U.S. states, in terms of Europe and Japan, and most of the industrialized world now has actual laws regulating greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a growing patchwork that does concern a lot of businesses. And frankly, we had sort of a very interesting discussion about why is it good to have national policy, and we said, you know, you can leave the leadership to the courts, you know, and state governments, or you could have the national government lead. And I think when faced with that choice, businesses do not want this to become the next asbestos or the next tobacco litigation kind of model. So there's a lot of fear of that kind of chaotic tort litigation model unfolding here if we don't act soon.
I noticed in your statement you were very clear that the government really has to take the lead on this. It's not going to be a self-organized marketplace solution, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think that's been an evolution where 3 or 4 years ago when the investment community first was thinking about this issue, they thought about it in terms of, all right, let's just get an understanding of the risk, let's get some disclosure from companies. That was cutting edge 3 or 4 years ago, and then the clean tech boom started maybe 2 years ago, and people thought, oh, we can make a lot of money on this. And then what actually happened was a lot of the clean tech people realized that you can't really get to scale with a lot of these clean technologies unless you have a government policy that incentivizes the development of those and stops rewarding the fossil fuel related industries. So that's a big shift where the investment community now, historically, right, completely anti-regulation has started to, it's not complete. I mean, there's a huge division, obviously, within Wall Street and the investment community still on merits of regulation versus not. But I think there's a growing tide of support for government action.
So what exactly are you calling for? Are you leaving the details strategically blank?
Well, the target and timetable is ambitious. It's 60 to 90% reductions below 1990 levels by 2050. So that's that's in line with the most ambitious legislation being proposed on Capitol Hill right now, and that's a national reduction target. So it's saying that the United States should set an example and not just point the finger at China and India that are developing nations that really haven't caused the problem over the last 200 years. I mean, it's really important that people understand we need the U.S. to lead, and then by doing that, the U.S. will then be able to enter into a global negotiation. But the second part is that the government needs to really align energy and transportation policies so that we have climate objectives being met. So that includes, all sorts of efforts in the area of fuel and transportation that we can get into if you're interested. But the final area is really the investor-specific one about investors need better disclosure, and the Securities and Exchange Commission should be requiring and enforcing companies' disclosure on this topic.
Well, what sort of disclosure are you referring to?
Well, the SEC already requires disclosure of any material risks, and the investors have been asking the SEC for the past 3 years to enforce and kind of clarify that current disclosure requirements really do include climate change, and we just want the SEC to make some statement that all companies should be disclosing the material risks they face from climate change, and that would have a big impact if the SEC were to do that, because it would affect all companies, and investors have a right to know this information, and they're not. We've done a survey of the S&P 500 and found really poor disclosure and just absolute non-disclosure in lots of cases. So that's a problem that has to be fixed immediately, just from a protecting investor standpoint.
And you mentioned some fuel and transportation issues. What exactly do you have in mind there?
The investors are not in Washington kind of crafting the details of whether it's best to raise the CAFE standard or do some other transportation policy that would reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. But that's the level that they're comfortable now, is to say we need to stimulate development of new technologies and also just deploy existing technologies. That's one of the main portfolios. There's a great study from the Princeton team of Rob Sokolow and Stephen Pakula, and they have a number of wedges that can get us toward a low-carbon future and get us toward the reduction target. And it's largely about how we use and produce energy, both in electric power and electricity and buildings, but also in the transportation sector. So if we're going to get there, we need much more ambitious national policies on both energy and transportation.
But does that mean that we're going to have to do something about the physical configuration of how we live? Is sprawl environmentally sustainable?
Well, I can speak as a personal point of view on that one. I mean, the investors have not gotten into a discussion about sprawl, but obviously infrastructure, both in the U.S. and in developing countries, is going to lock in the energy use patterns for decades to come. So we have put in place an understanding of that part of it. We haven't gotten into a detailed discussion of it. But if you think about the impact of a Goldman Sachs, for instance, financing infrastructure development in China or India, that there are huge implications here from decisions that investors are making, even and obviously governments are making, but private flows of capital, are vastly more powerful in some ways than what governments are doing worldwide. So that, that is a great point. We're going to be continuing to update this group that signed on all the upcoming legislative developments on climate change and on energy and on transportation, so they can decide if they want to come out with additional statements.
I notice your statement refers to establishing a carbon price. How exactly you mean that? Is it some sort of cap and trade scheme, a carbon tax? What exactly are you looking for?
There was a debate about that, so we agreed to not call for a specific regulatory approach and leave that to the experts who are designing that and to the politicians who will get into a major debate about that in the coming weeks. But it's the key thing is to establish the economy-wide carbon price so that the market can get the right kind of signal. The investors were not comfortable picking one regulatory approach over another. That's really more for the public policymakers to get into.
What do you have planned to transform this from a very high-sounding statement into a political reality? What's the lobbying strategy?
Well, the signers have already been meeting with members of Congress. There was a letter sent to President Bush on Monday, and a letter sent to the SEC, and a letter sent to all members of Congress, and then immediately, Al Gore mentioned this in his remarks yesterday in front of the House and Senate. So there's been a education of dozens of senators already and dozens of members of Congress already, so that investors do want them to act sooner rather than later to tackle this issue, and that it's good for the economy if they do. So the continued outreach will occur over the next few weeks, and we're hopeful that there might be some interesting hearings on this issue on the Hill, and we'll assess our next steps after we get through the initial outreach to Congress on this.
Yeah, but what is the administrative structure? Are you running out of a set of series or that you're the ones
who coordinate? Yep, that's right. It's a project of the Investor Network on Climate Risk, which is over $4 trillion of investors that have decided to coordinate efforts on this issue. So there's about 50 investors from around the country that have become members of this Investor Network, and CERES is the coalition that created this and coordinates INCR.
Yeah, $4 trillion is a serious amount of money, even by the standards of the U.S. capital markets. I noticed that letter you sent to President Bush. Any response from the White House yet?
Not yet. We are hopeful that he'll agree to a meeting and or his staff, and we will hope that this kind of a constituency shows that this is a bipartisan, nonpartisan issue at this point, and that it really is in the interest of the U.S. economy to get on with clarifying U.S. policy in this area.
All right. Thanks for your time, and good luck with the venture.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was Chris Fox, who is with CERES, the Soulful Capitalist Group up in Boston. And notice that he got a little vague at some points. I think that's because of the kinds of organization we're dealing with. An organization of big capital is going to get kind of vague about just how severe it's going to be, how serious. They want to start talking about putting an end to sprawl. That might be controversial. They are kind of vague on exactly what policies to pursue. So I think that those highlight some of the risks of looking to a group like this for leadership. But on the other hand, there's not a whole lot of leadership coming from elsewhere in the society, so we got to look for look for help wherever we can find it. And another measure of this evolving elite consciousness about climate change. I'm reading from the U.S. Economics Analyst, January 26, 2007, by Goldman Sachs. They say climate, through the title of this piece, Climate Policy, a Big Shift After 2008. Although President Bush acknowledged the serious problem of global climate change in the State of the Union address, he avoided a commitment to a binding emissions cap. This is in tune with polls revealing concern about climate change in the U.S. public, but little willingness to pay for abatement, with the advice of some economists advocating a go-slow policy. Well, that's less true now than it was in January. We do not expect Bush to accept a mandatory emissions cap in the remainder of his term if one emerges from Congress. However, after 2008, continues Goldman Sachs, the probability of an aggressive climate law rises significantly. Signs of a shift are already visible in several increasingly stringent plans from Congress, the state of California, and a coalition dubbed U.S. CAP, that's the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, that includes some of the largest U.S. energy and basic materials producers. Both the California and U.S. CAP plans call for absolute cuts in U.S. carbon dioxide emissions of 60% to 80% by 2050 and are quite close in spirit to the approach recently proposed by Sir Nicholas Stern, an economic advisor to the U.K. government. So this is big capital expecting something to happen over the next few years. And people who control $4 trillion of assets are not the kinds of people who are used to getting the finger from the White House. So we will see what comes of all this. So let's go out with a bit of upbeat music from – who is this from? Oh, yes, it's Cass and Mangan. I Love Your Shoes, reworked by Satoshi Tomy. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Till next week, bye.
My senses and rewind, replace my memory.